What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon. Glad you're with us here on EWTN Radio. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, not exclusively, if you must know, because we do get a lot of calls from Catholics who are inquiring perhaps for a friend or a neighbor or a coworker. Maybe they have some questions about the Catholic faith that this person could not answer. Or if that's you and you're a non-Catholic, we'd love to hear your questions today here on Call to Communion. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. You'll get it like almost immediately. Once you get that response, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email anytime you wish, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Vanessa Sanchez on the phones, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. Rich is tuned in to YouTube and Facebook, because we're streaming on both those platforms right now. And if you want to ask a question via those platforms, just put it there in the comments box, if you would, please. And Rich will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing decent, thank you.
Are you getting ready for the weekend? You know, the weather here in Alabama is just absolutely fantastic.
Well, I am, actually, and I've got to travel out of town to give a talk for Archangel Radio in Mobile, Alabama.
Our dear friends
so
in, Mobile.
I'm very much looking forward to that, and they're great friends. And, you know, actually, the guy who runs the station down there, Mike Romano, was the first radio producer I ever worked with.
No kidding.
Yep.
Back in the day.
Exactly. Back in the day.
Well, fantastic. Well, you be sure and give everybody our best there at Archangel Radio.
I sure will.
Catching up on a little unfinished business from yesterday's program, we got a question from DJ watching us on YouTube that we just ran out of time. We couldn't get to his question. Here it is for DJ, who says, where in the Bible did Jesus claim he was a Catholic person?
Yeah, so the phrase, I am a Catholic person, never occurs in the Bible to the best of my knowledge. But I think that's irrelevant. I mean, as a Catholic person myself, I would find it odd and strange for Christ to identify himself as a Catholic person. And it's not what I'm looking for from Christ, right? So Christ identifies himself as the Messiah of Israel, the Son of God, and the Savior of the human race, who's come to preach reconciliation between God and humanity, and of human decency of one man towards another, and repentance in view of the coming kingdom of God. I mean, that's essentially Christ's message.
Yeah.
And he conveys that message in his way of life to a set of disciples that he charges with continuing it until he comes again, and he promises to come again.
Mm-hmm.
And he empowers them to do so and to teach that way of life to others. In fact, commands them to go unto all nations and make disciples and teach them everything he's commanded them, and promises his divine assistance until the end of the world. He tells them that whatever they bind on earth will be bound in heaven, that whatever they loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. He gives to one of them the keys of the kingdom of heaven. He says, whoever hears you, hears me. Whoever rejects you, rejects me. And those disciples, now called apostles, for they were sent by Christ, themselves appointed successors to their apostolic ministry and gave instructions that their successors do likewise in perpetuity. And so the structure of the Catholic Church that Catholics believe in practice was established by Christ to be the continuation, the extension of his presence and ministry on earth. That's what we mean by the Catholic Church. The word Catholic just simply means universal, And it refers to what Christ had already explained, namely that the disciples were to go into all of the world. That's what Catholic means, the whole world. But the word Catholic, the Greek word Catholic, was first applied to the institution founded by Christ by a bishop in Antioch in Syria. It's called Ignatius of Antioch. He was the third bishop of Antioch after St. Peter, and he's the first to use the language Catholic to describe this thing that Christ did.
Very good. And DJ, thanks for watching us on YouTube. Another YouTuber was Daniel, sent this to us yesterday. How important is the rosary, and what is the power behind it?
Right. So the importance of the rosary is 100% dependent on the utility that you find within it, right? So it's not part of the church's liturgy. It's not mandated by the church. It wasn't commanded by Christ. It's an historical development within the Latin Catholic Church that many, many Christians, many Catholics have found enormously useful in their spiritual lives, but not everyone. Famously, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, who was 19th century saint, but really probably the most famous saint in the 20th century. I mean, yeah. Just everybody's kind of beloved Catholic doctor of the church. Famously didn't like the rosary and didn't like to pray it very much and said she didn't get a lot of benefit out of it. So you can be a magnificent Catholic saint and not pray the rosary. In the Eastern traditions of the Catholic Church, the rosary is almost non-existent. They have other devotions and ways of honoring Our Lady that are more prominent. So, you know, the popes and many spiritual teachers have commended the rosary as a exemplary form of prayer and meditation that can do great benefit to the souls that take it up. But my advice would be try it out, you know, give it a shot, see if it works for you. If you find yourself growing in faith, hope, and charity as a result of your engagement with the rosary and you like it, stick with it. But the important thing is to find the devotional practice that motivates you to acts of faith, hope, and charity, and that may or may not be the rosary in your case.
Very good. Daniel, thanks for watching us on YouTube. Hey, quick shout out to our very own Father Dominic Marie, who has been with us for 21 years now, ordained back in the day. Also, Father Miguel Mary, who was also ordained on this day in 2004. God bless you. Congratulations from all of us here at EWTN to Father Dominic and Father Miguel. What wonderful, wonderful men and holy men these are. They may disagree with that, but I think they're holy dudes, and I'm proud to call them both my friends. In a moment, we're going to get to the phones here and talk with Hunter, a first-time caller driving through Northern Virginia. A couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. We do have one line open. One line. You can grab it by calling 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Or if you wish, text the letters EWTN to 58177. I want to give another shout out to our friends there at Oklahoma Catholic Radio. The president of said Oklahoma Catholic Radio, Jeff Fennell, tells us that their newest station is now on the air in McAllister, Oklahoma. That is KMSJ 90.9 FM. Congratulations to Father Jovita and his staff at St. John the Evangelist in McAllister for getting the station on the air. Now, why is this a bigger deal than normal? Well, because KMSJ is located 2 miles from the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister. You may have heard of it. It's known as Big Mac. This makes it ideal to get the EWTN radio signals over the walls of the prison to minister to the men inside. This has been a goal of Oklahoma Catholic Radio to minister to these inmates for over a decade. Jeff says, thank God he has blessed Oklahoma with this new radio station. We would echo that. And a big shout out to everybody now listening to us for the very first time on KMSJ 90.9 FM in McAllister, Oklahoma. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Hunter, a first-time caller, driving through Northern Virginia, listening to us on YouTube. Hello, Hunter. What's on your mind today?
Hello, Dr. Ant. I love your show, and thank you for having me. So I have a two questions. They're both from my Protestant friend who's about this close, within a hair's breadth, becoming Catholic.
Okay.
And I figured I'd bum them off of you. So my first question, his first question is, could you like recommend a book about the historicity of the Catholic Church? And the second question is about the indulgences and like what are their origins and how has the practice evolved over time, especially as it relates to like the Protestant Reformation?
Yeah, sure. So a kind of an accessible one volume history of the Catholic Church would be James Hitchcock's book on the history of the Catholic Church. I think we have it in the EWTN religious catalog. On the question of indulgences were an innovation born from the bottom up and not the top down. And I think that's really important for Protestants who object to Catholicism to understand, because the caricature is that indulgences are something invented by the Pope to raise money for the rebuilding of St. Peter's. That's, you know, that's the way Luther characterized indulgences, as a kind of abuse of the faithful. And historically, they weren't imposed from the top down. Certainly not as a revenue-generating mechanism. They were proposed from the bottom up. And the reason why is that in antiquity, when Christians engaged in bad behavior, they would be made to do penance. And as Christ indicates in Matthew 18 that they're supposed to, and St. Paul also in 1 Corinthians 5, and sometimes those penances could last a long time. Sometimes they could last for years. If there's a particularly egregious fault, like murder or adultery or apostasy, Christians could be barred from the Eucharist for a very long time, consigned to an order of penitence, and that could be quite burdensome and painful. Now, during the Decian persecution of the 3rd century in the 250s, there were a number of people that were martyred for their faith. There were some that confessed Christ and went to prison. There were others who lapsed and denied Christ under persecution. The latter group was disciplined by the church for the sin of apostasy, and they would be barred from the Eucharist for a very long time, sometimes until death. But then there was this group of people in the church called the confessors who were languishing in prison because of their faithful witness to Jesus. And what some of the faithful did that were in penance was they had this brilliant idea. They said, you know, there are these guys over here that are in prison, and they were noble, we weren't noble. Surely there's merit associated with their sacrifice. What if they share some of that with us? And I wonder if we could go to the bishop and say, look here, you know, Bob over here in prison says that he's doing time, he might as well do it for me. So you should cut off, you know, say 10 years of my penance, because Bob's going to offer his sacrifice on my behalf. The merits of the confessors applied to me. And they went over to the prisons and they said, yo, Bob, it's my idea. Question, would you write me a writ of indulgence? Asking the confessors in prison to like write out a testimony saying, I'm doing my penance on behalf of Dave over here so that you, Bishop Cyprian, will let him go, let him out of penance a little bit early. And so they tried this out and they took it to the bishop. And the bishop said, this is St. Cyprian, he says, yeah, well, the logic works because we believe in the communion of saints. Yeah, we believe that, you know, the merits of the few can avail, you know, for the benefit of the many. That's a very biblical concept. If you don't believe me, go read Genesis 18. So I like the idea. It's a good idea, guys. I like it. I approve. One request, and that is the disposition of this thing needs to be within the bishop's jurisdiction. So no more of this going to the prisons and getting your writ of indulgence. Okay, you come to me, and I'll write the writ of indulgence, and then, yeah, we'll let you off, okay? Thus was born the practice of indulgences. It's the idea of applying the merits of the saints to remit the temporal punishment due to sin. In this case, temporal punishment actually imposed by the church itself, right? And that practice continued basically ever since. Now, you know, what the church would do is, well, we can't just let these people off completely scot-free. Then there's no motive, you know, to change of life and holiness. So, you know, we'll ask them to do some sort of token, right? And then we'll assign the penance. And you know, today that token, you know, might be, you know, pray a rosary or read scripture for 30 minutes or something like that. We'll give you an indulgence. But one of the works of mercy that is commended by Christ is giving alms. And so you can say, well, you know, give alms to a beggar and then I'll give you an indulgence. All right. Well, you can see how once you start the whole business of like, well, let's give alms as your condition of getting the penance, then the unscrupulous people saw an opportunity for revenue generation. And so that's where that business came from. And eventually, of course, that gets out of bounds and it becomes a great mechanism to raise money for the rebuilding of St. Peter's, hence the corruption, right?
Sure.
And Luther's critique of that is just, and there were Catholics who had critiqued it at the time. He wasn't the first person to critique it. And everybody recognized that that was really bad optics for the church. And so the church forbid that practice, and it is no longer acceptable to offer indulgences in exchange for temporal donations, either to the poor or to the church, right? We just don't do that anymore. We learned our lesson at the Reformation. Indulgences, however, still exist within the Catholic Church based on the very sound theology that surrounded their emergence in the third century.
Hunter, we hope that's helpful for you and for your friend. Thanks so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Alex in Cincinnati, listening on the great AM 740 Sacred Heart Radio. Hello, Alex. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a non-denominational friend, and we regularly partake in very fruitful debates about our faith. And he made a point when the Pope was elected, he was asking me about it, and he said that in the verse where Jesus tells Peter, "You are the rock, and upon the rock I build my church," that he was actually speaking to all of the apostles, and that would be apparent to any person that spoke Koine Greek or Aramaic. And I just want to know if you could go through the language of that and explain.
Yeah, just a second. I'm actually pulling the Greek up while we speak right now, just to make sure I don't misquote here or misspeak. Just give me one second. Dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum.
Okay. We need the Jeopardy theme music here.
Yeah, I've got the text up. Okay, I'm looking at it. Okay. Okay, just wanted to double check. I thought I knew what I was talking about.
All right.
Yep, singular pronoun. Sorry. Singular pronoun, not plural pronoun.
So it wasn't apparent.
No. And Matt, let me just read the text in English translation.
Please.
Okay. Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. I tell you," singular, "that you are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell will not overcome it. I will give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven."
That's it.
All right, there you go. Yep. So, yeah, sorry.
Sorry about that, Alex. Actually, I'm not sorry about that at all.
Oh.
Alex, thanks so much for your call. Call to communion here on EWTN. Still lines available for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Ed is listening in Southern West Virginia on the EWTN app. Hello, Ed. What's on your mind today?
I have some friends. Dr. Anders, I have some friends that asked me a question about why the big thing now about the Latin Mass has come up within the church.
Yeah.
The big course in Charlotte went one way 2 days ago, and today I think he went the other way a little bit, but he's going to wait till October. So I don't really think there's a consensus on whether they should continue to have the Latin Mass in the places where they have it, which is nowhere near me. But I understand that, I guess they're asking me, my friends are, why is there such a problem in the church about deciding how to say the Mass all of a sudden? It's always been that way since most people could remember. So.
Sure. So if you want to change someone's life, I think there are three ways that you can do it. This is my personal opinion.
Okay.
You can disagree with me if you like. Well, maybe I should say there are three conditions. All right. The first one is you better engage their attention. If you don't have their attention, I mean, how can you enlist any kind of intentional activity on their part? You got to hold their attention.
Sure.
Secondly, you need to engage their agency somehow. I mean, like, you can hold my attention with a good series on Netflix, but you're not engaging my agency. You're not really changing me, right?
Okay.
And then the third way is through enculturation. And this can be more subtle and unconscious, but like when all the people around you start thinking and acting a certain way, humans are overwhelmingly likely to start thinking and acting the way that their peers that they associate with think and act, right? And there's sociology. There's a sociologist named Samuel Stroop who actually did a study on how likely people are to believe in the orthodoxy of their tradition based on their social embeddedness in the community. Like, the more friends you have that you go to church with, the more likely you are to think and act like the way your the orthodoxy of your tradition teaches you to act. Okay, and it is a fact of Catholic life in North America today that many people are not, their attention is not engaged by the Mass. I mean, it's just not, right? They're bored. They don't pay attention, don't know what's going on. Their agency is not engaged. They show up on Sunday mornings, maybe late, maybe they leave early. They, you know, they check the box and they go back to their sporting events and it's like they never went. Their attention is not engaged. Their agency is not engaged. And it, they certainly are not being enculturated because that's not where their social circles lie. Like, they maybe they go to Mass for some nostalgic reason because they went as kids or their grandfather was Catholic or something, but they're, it's just not, it's not engaging them in a way that's transformative for their lives, right? And when those people get on a spiritual quest, well, sometimes they end up leaving the Catholic Church altogether and going off and maybe joining a Protestant denomination that they feel does a better job of engaging them at, the, at that level, okay? And so that's a, that's just a reality. That's just a pastoral reality I'm describing. It's not everybody's experience, but it is the experience of enough people, right?
Okay.
And,
all right.
And so, you, like, Catholic ministers, not just priests, but anybody who's engaged in, like, trying to actively promote the Catholic faith and convey it to people, have ideas about, well, how to overcome this, right? How can I lay hold of people's attention, engage their agency, and enculturate them in a way that's transformative in their lives?
Well, and, I just have to jump in. Yeah. What do you mean by agency?
You're acting.
Acting.
Like that you do things.
Okay.
That you get up and get involved.
Got it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And so people obviously have different ideas about this. And naturally, their respective ideas about how to do this, how to actually engage people and change them and help them, will reflect, to a certain extent, their ideological commitments, right?
Okay.
And there are some people who have an ideology of, well, antiquarianism, that a thing is better for being older.
Okay.
And or maybe a kind of ideology of esotericism, meaning, like, a thing is better if it is, if it has the appearance of being more mysterious. And I think that or, you know, we might call it traditionalism. A thing is better for being more traditional.
Okay.
And so there are some communities of Catholics that form around that ideological vision that gravitate towards, say, a traditional celebration of the Mass. And then they point to the success of those communities to reinforce that sense that, hey, look, we've built intentional communities where people are more actively engaged, and they're sort of captivated by the mystery of the Latin Mass. So you got their attention, you got their agency, you have their sort of tight knit community, and it seems to work, right? And there are other communities that do that as well. So sometimes we'll get calls on this show from people that are part of, like, say, the charismatic Catholic movement.
Okay.
Well, you can get more polar opposite than traditionalists with the Latin Mass over here and charismatics with their charismata over here. But they both answer that problem by offering something that seems a little bit off the beaten path, that's arresting, that's salient, that grabs the attention, and they're usually very intentional communities, right? Now, as a practicing Catholic myself, I think, yay, good for you guys. Like, good for engaging people and getting them involved in something that gets them living the Catholic life in a more intentional way, right? The problem comes in when, whether it's the traditionalist who's into the Latin Mass or the charismatic or whatever your thing is, says, ours is the only way. We've got the stuff, right? All you other normal Catholics out there, y'all don't have the real thing. And they may invent superstitious explanations for why their community seems to be thriving and growing that put everybody else in the Catholic world down. Not everybody does that, but some people do. Some people. And you will meet traditionalists or charismatics or ideologues of one stripe or another who will say, yeah, my community's got the stuff and you don't. And I've been to Latin Masses that I found tremendously edifying and beautiful. And I've been to others that were pretty ideologically possessed with that kind of spirit. And they're very different places, right? Come back to this thought after the break.
Yeah, stick with us there, Ed. We'll continue this on the other side. We'll also get to a text we received from Mary, and lines are open for you. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Hey, Hey, glad you're with us for this Call to Communion Thursday program here on EWTN. A couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. You know, we try to get to as many calls as we can in our 53 minutes or so each and every day. 833-288-3986. Before the break, we were talking with Ed in Southern West Virginia, who was asking about the big push that he's experiencing for the Latin Mass. It doesn't seem that popular. So what's the skinny on the Latin Mass?
So before the break, I was describing, at least as the way I see it,
why
some Latin Mass communities and other intentional communities within the Catholic Church, not just the Latin Mass, but there are other groups that sort of have a thing going apart, that seem to experience a lot of growth and success and enthusiasm by their adherents. And, like, I think that's a good thing. If you can get people drawn into the life of the Catholic faith, that's a good thing. Let's keep doing it. You go start your intentional community, get the blessing of your bishop, and off you go, right? That's fine. The problem comes in when you get your intentional community going, whether that's a Latin Mass community or charismatic community or some other kind of intentional community, and then you get the ideological conviction that, well, ours is the only way to do this, and we're having success, obviously, because we've got God and you don't, or some words to that effect. And I have encountered people in these communities, Latin Mass community in particular, that have explicitly told me, well, we think that almost in a kind of magical way, we think that the prayers of the Latin Mass are just intrinsically more efficacious. You say those prayers, you're just going to get closer to God. Well, that's not a Catholic position to hold at all, right? That's a superstitious way of thinking about it. And some of them, and again, I'm not trying to characterize the whole movement.
Sure.
I'm talking about a few bad apples, right?
Okay.
It's a few bad apples in there that have even gone so far as to really put down the Pope and the bishops and the ordinary form of the Mass that is universal throughout the Church, with a kind of hubris and elitism. And Pope Francis saw that, and he was very worried about it, and so he instituted some restrictions on the Latin Mass because in his mind, he thought the Latin Mass had become a source of division in the modern Church because of the tendency of a few bad apples to be kind of elitist. Now, we can have long debates about whether he accurately characterized the movement and how representative those attitudes are, but that was his motivation, right?
Okay, all right.
Right. And so what happened in some dioceses around the world is, as bishops have moved to implement the Pope's restrictions on the Latin Mass, they have been, well, let us say, more or less aggressive.
Okay.
Right. And we might speculate about, to what extent their own personal liturgical ideology plays into those pastoral decisions. Well, I don't think we need to speculate. I think it's pretty evident, right? And that application is, say, more vigorous in some dioceses than others, and it definitely reflects the liturgical priorities of the local ordinary.
Okay.
And so I think that explains a lot of the present controversy. And I mean, I think that we ought to obey our bishops, and we ought to obey the Pope, and we ought to, within the confines of the law, find that expression of the liturgy that most motivates me to faith, hope, and charity, and never forget that charity must include charity for all the Catholics who don't worship like me.
Well, yeah. Ed, thanks so much for checking in from Southern West Virginia. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Somebody told me years ago that Thomas Aquinas, you would know better than me, once said that obedience is everything. Did he really say that?
I don't know if Thomas said that. It doesn't seem like a very Thomistic thing to say, honestly.
No.
I think Thomas would say, charity is everything. And Thomas had a lot to say about all the virtues. But maybe he did, but doesn't
could
seem
be.
Very Thomistic
could be.
To me.
Hey, if you're listening to us on the Guadalupe Radio Network, your station needs to hear from you next week. The GRN will be airing their summer share-a-thon starting on Monday. So if you're listening to us in Texas or Kansas, New Mexico, here in Alabama, Florida, Virginia, Washington, D.C., please support your Catholic radio station. They got to pay the light bill, okay, and other things as well. So do support your local Catholic radio station. Call to Communion here on EWTN. I have time for one or two more phone calls at 833-288-EWTN, maybe a couple more, 833-288-3986. Paul is in Youngstown, Ohio, listening on the great Living Bread Radio. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Anders.
Hi.
I read recently that the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew has visited twice already with Pope Leo XIV. and I wondered if you knew anything, any inside information. Is there a planned reunion in the works?
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So there is absolutely a plan to reunify with the Orthodox Church, and the plan is 971 years old, right? So most people date the split between the East and West to 1054. And since 1054, there have been many, many efforts at the reconciliation of East and West, and some of them have accomplished more and some of them have accomplished less. So, you know, probably one of the most important attempts to unite East and West was the Reunion Council of Florence that took place in the 15th century between 1431 and 1445. And it didn't succeed, but it laid out kind of as a framework. I mean, here are the issues that are in contention that the council's attitude was, you know, here are all the issues. Now all you Orthodox people get on board, right? It wasn't maybe so sensitive to the Orthodox perspective, but it laid out the issues pretty well. You know, there have been other attempts through the centuries. You know, what's sometimes called the Uniate movement, or the movement to reconcile individual groups of Orthodox churches. These Eastern rites of the Catholic Church that are in union with the Pope, and most of those have a sort of historical point of origin since the 11th century, with the exception of the Maronites, who were never out of union with the Pope. They've always been in union with the Pope.
Okay.
And then the modern world. You know, there have been, you know, since the 20th century, there have been any number of attempts for dialogue and furthering understanding. And I think the ecumenical movement, you know, took a major leap forward around the Second Vatican Council. And, you know, Paul VI was frequently welcoming Eastern patriarchs to the Vatican, as did his successors, John Paul II and Benedict and Francis and now Pope Leo. So, yeah, the intent is very much there. Efforts have been underway. They've shifted and changed over history. But like I say, they're really nearly 1,000 years old, those efforts at reunification. So I'm optimistic, but not holding my breath.
Got it. Paul, thanks so much for your call from Youngstown, Ohio. Let's go to Dan now. Dan is in Johnston, South Carolina, and he's listening on the great St. Paul Radio. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today, sir?
I was wondering, after the resurrection, when Jesus told Mary Magdalene not to hold on to him for he had not yet ascended, what was going on there?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, you know, when we read sacred scripture, remember that we have the historical narrative of the events that happened in the Gospels, but then the church tells us there's also a spiritual interpretation of those. So, you know, we're not just leaving it as an historical narrative. We're saying, what is the universal lesson that we can all gain from this? That's a sort of spiritual significance for us. And what Christ is telling what he's telling Mary Magdalene is that the ascension matters for our redemption. You know, when I have ascended, I will draw all men to myself. St. Paul says in the book of Colossians, set your heart not on earthly things, but on heavenly things where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. And there's something about the ascension of Christ that sort of universalizes the gospel. The gospel was always universal. It was always meant for all nations. But by literally ascending to heaven and then sending the disciples out to the four corners of the world, you know, we're not tempted to think, well, you know, I've got to go to where King Jesus is in Jerusalem. You know, the Catholic Church has a feast called the Feast of Christ the King. It exemplifies the fact that Christ is King of the whole world. And there's something about the ascension, his session in heaven, that raises that to, say, cosmological levels beyond, you know, just a temporal king in a place on earth. The ascension of Christ also illustrates beautifully God's vindication of the Son of God, right? Because he was condemned to death by the Romans as a criminal. A Jew and Roman alike thought, well, this is the end of the Jesus guy. We got rid of him. We put him to death in the most ignominious fashion possible. He rose from the dead, was seen by a few. But, you know, in the pagan world, the apotheosis of some ancient hero was a sign of divine favor, right? So, you know, Hercules gets ascended to heaven and he gets his own little constellation, this sort of thing, you know. And of course, we're not pagans. We don't believe in that kind of divinity. But nevertheless, the idea still stands that the idea of an ascent into heaven clearly indicates divine favor. So both from the perspective of humanity's way of looking at Christ as a heavenly king, and God vindicating Christ fully by the resurrection and the ascension. The ascension is an essential part of the gospel message and of redemption. And Mary Magdalene needs to come, as always, all of us do, need to come to learn to embrace him under that description.
Okay. And we thank you so much for your call from Johnston, South Carolina, Dan. It's Called a Communion here on EWTN. One of our wonderful weekend programs is the Great Register Radio. It's been produced by our friends at the National Catholic Register and EWTN many years now. On our next program, Saturday afternoon, 4 p.m. Eastern, you know, earlier we were talking about the traditional Latin Mass. Well, on our next program, the Bishop of Charlotte, North Carolina, postponing a plan that would have placed severe limits on the traditional Latin Mass. The Register's senior editor, Jonathan Lytle, will be discussing this as well as other stories in the news. Do check it out Saturday afternoon, 4 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on EWTN Radio. All right, let's go to Logan now in Aberdeen, South Dakota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hello, Logan. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. Yeah, my question regards the claim that Catholics in throughout history have squashed down the translating of the Bible into English, one of those being William Tyndale. Could you clarify why exactly he was executed? I mean, what role did the Catholic Church have to play in that?
Yeah, sure. So let me back up a little bit and talk about Bible translation, right, within the Catholic Church and its history. So first of all, the reason there is a Bible is the Catholic Church put it together and promulgated it to the world as the Word of God. And the translation of the Scriptures from their original languages into the vernacular has been something that Catholics have been involved with for 2,000 years. And you can go study the history of Bible translations and biblical manuscripts, and you know, you'll find them in archaic Saxon, in archaic French, in archaic Gothic. I mean, you name it. I mean, like, throughout the Middle Ages, early modern period, Catholics are involved in the translation of the Bible.
Uh-huh.
For a very long time in the English-speaking world, the Douay Rheims translation of the Bible was a Catholic-authorized translation of the Bible into the vernacular for use of with English-speaking Catholics, kind of in competition with the King James Version.
Okay.
So there have always been Catholic translations. I mean, the standard version of the Bible in the Middle Ages, the Latin Vulgate, was itself a translation into the vernacular. I mean, St. Jerome translated the Bible from Greek and Hebrew into the language of the common people. The reason it's called the Vulgate, it's not written in Ciceronian Latin. It's written in the common Latin of the man on the street, right? So Catholics have always been involved in the vernacular translation of the Bible. Now, in the 14th and 15th centuries, there was a movement, well, it really starts earlier than that. Herbert Grunemann has a great book called The Religious Movements of the Late Middle Ages that treats this sort of effervescence of sort of democratic, anarchical spirituality that sort of poured out of every corner in the late Middle Ages for all kinds of reasons. Lester Little's book on the poverty movement is another example of that genre of scholarship, that could either work with or against church authority, right? And sometimes it worked with in the persons of, say, St. Francis and St. Dominic. Other times it worked in direct opposition to the Catholic hierarchy, as, for example, the Cathar movement in late medieval France. But one version of that sort of religious effervescence was a reform movement associated with John Wycliffe in England, who had a pretty radical ideology, and it involved, among other things, the idea that Catholics, Christians, didn't owe obedience to temporal or spiritual authorities if those authorities were in the state of mortal sin. That's a very deeply anarchical position to take. Imagine if you said, well, you know, if the cop pulls you over but he's in mortal sin, you know, you can just give him the finger and walk away, right? I mean, you couldn't maintain civil order in a regime where my private judgment as to your spiritual state determined whether or not I was obligated
that,
to you.
Yeah, that
right?
doesn't work.
It doesn't work, right? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that Wycliffe was preaching. And because he was sort of anti-hierarchical and democratic in his dispositions, the vernacular translation of the Bible became for Wycliffe kind of one of the rallying points around which he conceived an opposition to the church. Now, again, appealing to Scripture against corruption was a Catholic thing to do. It's what St. Francis did. It's what St. Dominic did. So there's a Catholic way of doing that that doesn't require total rejection of hierarchical order in church and state, right? And but Wycliffe did. The Hussites, his heirs in Bohemia, did the same. And so there was about a 200-year period where the church started getting nervous about a kind of unguided lay access to sacred scripture infected by these kinds of heretical attitudes that were leading directly to attacks on church and state. Okay, now, this is unfamiliar to people today because we're so used to the kind of separation of church and state that we have in the modern order that we get real, you know, get bristly about this. But before, in a time before constitutional government, sort of the Christian order was the constitution of the state and of the civil society. And so someone who attacks, say, the order of society, right, whether that be conceived ecclesiastically or governmentally, be tantamount to, like, say, you know, somebody who was maybe think of the Red Scare in early 20th century America, right, when you know, the belief is, okay, there are agents out there in civil society that are trying to directly undermine the Constitution, the stability of the government, and foment revolution, right? And the kind of attitude that a Catholic would have had towards certain heretical positions in the late Middle Ages would be similar to, let's say, Eisenhower woke up and found a copy of the Communist Manifesto on his bedside table, right? He'd think, uh-oh, you know, the Reds are in the house. We got to do something radical. Okay, well, 100 years later, that's exactly what happened to Francis I. So Francis goes to bed at night. He wakes up in the morning, and what does he find tacked on the inside of his bedroom door? He finds a series of placards attacking the Catholic Mass in a civilization where the sacrality of kingship, in other words, the civil order of government, is intimately connected to the sacramental order. So this isn't just an attack on my private religion. This is conceived of as an attack on civil society that could lead potentially to anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so John Calvin, actually, one of the things that he does in his early translation of the Bible, he didn't translate the Bible, but he wrote a preface to a French translation of the Bible, is try to specifically address concerns about anarchy in the early Reformation, which were very, very real, right? So one of the things that that really propelled the Protestant Calvinist Reformation was there were these anarchic tendencies in, say, 1520s, 1530s France that were leading in sort of very dangerous directions from the perspective of the civil order. And Calvin's trying to make the argument that vernacular translation of the Bible by itself is not the primary cause there. And as long as people are well-tutored, they're well-instructed in the doctrines of the faith, they're not going to go all anarchical on you, right? That was his argument. Now, it turned out to go the opposite of that in his own church, and he spent the rest of his career kind of battling back the anarchists in his own community. But but nevertheless, that was the view, right?
Yeah.
So in that context, it's not that you're against the vernacular use of the Bible, but you're against its... First of all, you don't want just any Tom, Dick, and Harry translating the Bible and making it say whatever they want. So you want ecclesiastical authority. I mean, in fact, when one of the arguments for the King James Bible, which is the Protestant Bible, King James did not want Tyndale's version of the Bible. He didn't want it. Why? Because it undermined episcopal and therefore royal authority. Right? So there's a civil government justification for the King James Bible, and it's to counter democratic notions that were emerging from, say, Wycliffeite or Tyndale translations of the Bible. Right, so it's you can't judge this by 21st century standards of the separation of religion of church and state.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
In that context, Tyndale and his ilk, they weren't favored by anybody. Like Henry VIII, who will split from the Pope, is the one that instigated the persecution that Tyndale was fleeing, where he gets picked up at Antwerp by authorities of the Holy Roman Empire, who were asked by Henry VIII to pick him up.
Wow.
You see? So were there Catholics involved in Tyndale's execution? Yes. Do I think that's a good thing? No. I don't think it's a good thing. I don't think people should be executed for translating the Bible, right? But to read that without the proper context and the history of late medieval society and the way this stuff was shaking out is really to mischaracterize the thing, right? So am I justifying the execution of Tyndale? No. Did it happen? Yes. Does it make more sense in context? Yes.
There you go. Logan, thanks so much for your call today. Here is Kevin now in South Carolina watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Hello, Kevin. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, good afternoon. My question's in regards to the morality of modern secular media. So I recently saw a video online of Bishop Barron discussing some of the themes of morality in the TV show The Sopranos. So there seems to be some inherent value in the series. However, there's also lots of explicit nudity and sex scenes. So as Catholics, when watching media which contains nudity, sex scenes, kind of other mature themes, are we committing mortal or venial sins, or is this a case of scrupulosity? And how best do we judge these types of media?
Okay, thanks. So if you've ever been to Florence, Italy, you've likely visited Michelangelo's tremendous chef d'oeuvre, his masterpiece, The David. All right? And if you haven't noticed, David ain't wearing nothing.
Nope.
All right? I don't know about you, but I don't know anybody that has sort of fallen into a passionate pornographic reverie at the sight of the David, right? I mean, this is not, it's not eliciting those kinds of responses in the human heart, even though it's explicit nudity, right? And I forget which Supreme Court justice it was who is famous for saying...
Potter Stewart.
Okay, who said, you know, I can't give you a definition of pornography, but I know it when I see it, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, the line in the sand is... What's being evoked in you? What is being evoked in you? And what's the artistic purpose that's being served here? And look, this is my private judgment. You disagree with me if you want to, but I mean, I have tuned into Netflix. I have seen what's out there to a certain extent, and there is a certain class of modern television show that I think, like, almost requires. Like, I'm not saying they should. I'm saying the directors think they have to put this kind of stuff in there. Because they're trying to be salacious. They're trying to elicit viewership from people who want to see skin for those kinds of reasons,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, we know today that things like addiction to internet pornography are a huge, huge, enormous problem, right? So do you want to put yourself in a position where you're at risk of that? I don't think so.
No.
Right? So, you know, am I saying that no Catholic should ever watch a movie under any circumstance that contains, you know, skin? Well, I'm not going to make that judgment, but I am going to tell you, like, you better darn well be careful, right? You better darn well be careful, and it's hard for me to imagine that most of the directorial choices that are made with these kinds of films are made with the same motivation that, say, Michelangelo had when he carved the David.
Yeah, very different. Kevin, thanks so much for your call from South Carolina. Lynn is watching us on YouTube. Lynn says, could you explain about the church fathers, how their works are important as related with the separation of Protestants with the Catholic Church, and how to dive into their works as a beginner?
Yeah, so the fathers are important for a lot of reasons. First of all, they are you know, our earliest witnesses to the life of the Christian church after the age of the apostles, and so... You know, they evidence the antiquity of the faith and really help us have confidence in the continuity of the Catholic Church down for 2,000 years. And that has been a tremendous witness to many Protestants who have dived into the patrimony of the fathers and seen how far removed the fathers are from their own Protestant experience of faith. And then they say, well, you know, who worships like this today? And they start kicking around and they go, oh, the Catholics, right? That happened to me, right? This, many people have come to the Catholic faith from other versions of Christianity by reading the fathers. Many of the fathers also were just brilliant theologians. They were just brilliant theologians and spiritual masters whose works are valid and edifying just on their own rights. I mean, Augustine didn't write because he was trying to attract Protestants. There were no Protestants. He was writing to edify the faithful,
yeah,
and he's still edifying to this day, right? So they have just tremendous insights into the spiritual life. The fathers are often writing, you know, from with a completely different cultural and intellectual milieu that can get us out of our 21st century perspectives of, you know, materialism and consumerism, and benefit from wisdom, not only that's, you know, wisdom intrinsically on the face of it, but wisdom that's coming from a sort of very different intellectual culture than our own. So there's just all kinds of good reasons to read the fathers. The fathers, particularly when you note their unanimity with one another, you know, their common approach to questions of theology and Christian life and practice, again, is just a powerful witness of the Catholicity of the church and its uniformity down through time. In terms of how important are these for Protestants, again, early Protestants recognized that they needed continuity with the fathers in order to avoid the charge of innovation. And so John Calvin, Martin Luther, but especially Calvin, they love to cite the Fathers. They read the Fathers constantly.
Uh-huh.
And well-formed Protestants have been aware for 500 years that they need to be engaged in the writings of the Fathers. Now, when I first encountered the Fathers, it was with this polemical intent to prove my Protestantism. That didn't turn out very well for me.
Not really.
Right. But so here, sure. I am 20 plus years later as a Catholic in consequence.
It sure turned out well for us.
Well, you know, I don't know. That remains to be seen. You know, call no man happy till he's dead, Aristotle's verdict. So we'll see if I can run the race. But I'm trying my best.
I know you are. Lynn, thanks for watching us on YouTube today. Michael, driving through Ohio, I am so sorry we couldn't get to your call. You can hear the music playing. Please call us back on our next live program. We'll also get to a text from Mary that we didn't have time for today. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do it right here on EWTN Radio Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Check out the podcast at EWTN's Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price. We will see you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.